listening to a 9to5.cc podcast.
Welcome back to a brand new episode of the 9to5 Entertainment System. Hey, if you enjoy 9ES, and you do, because you're listening to it, be honest with yourself, we would love for you to give us a little bit of support over on patreon.com/9to5cc. Head over to patreon.com/9to5cc and support us either at the $1, you know, you just love us level, or at the I love 9ES level. If you do that, you'll get access to Garbage Time, which is the bonus episode that we record after every main episode. On this week's bonus episode, we talk about Riding on Horseback, the 1990 film American Movie, My Hero Academia, the board game, and AEW Revolution and Sting's Last Match. All this and more on Garbage Time. But on this, the main episode of the show you're listening to right now, we talk about getting blood tests when you're a kid and how maybe I'm the only one who did. We talk about what moon towers are. We talk about Austin food and drinks. We talk about Scott Pilgrim. We talk about comics. We talk about Ultimatum. We talk about the Wonka experience in Scotland, AI versus the New York Times, the final death of Vice, and Shoresy. Bye! Here it is. So do you know what I hated at the hospital?
What do you hate at the hospital?
What I used to hate.
The death of your loved one?
Well, I mean, yes. But I was going to say, but we were talking about how unprepared parents book all of their kids' hospital visits for spring break. So apparently it's a really good time to be off to take a vacation week for the hospital.
Yeah.
And some parents, allegedly, sources close to the hospital have informed me that allegedly people just lie to their kids and tell them it's like a checkup and not a blood test because kids are scared of blood tests.
I mean, that happens. Okay. Semi-regularly, but on March break week, it's the worst. It's full of that stuff.
So that's why you're off?
Well, no, I'm off because my kid has March break, but if I didn't have a kid, I would be off.
It would be a high-ranked week on the old calendar to take off. But what I hated is, and like I said, you guys are older than me, so maybe you experienced this as well, or I had just a sadistic, sicko pediatrician, but I used to get blood tests every checkup, first of all, and they it was the 80s. I don't know, it's just part of it. They're like, well, maybe not every checkup, once a year, because there's more than one checkup a year for a kid, I want to say.
Nope.
Is that normal?
Nope.
After you're like three, even once a year, man.
I don't know, there's stuff wrong with me, I guess.
It wasn't leeching,
but they used the little razor blade. They just slashed the tip of the finger, and I hated that so much. I was like, needles, please. Please, needles.
Keith, like, do you have a bleeding disorder? That's a clotting test.
I don't have a bleeding disorder. I clot fine.
Are you sure? Because there's no reason
was
to
your
do
doctor
the bleeding time
Nosferatu?
Test.
Was my doctor a Nosferatu? Maybe.
Yeah. There is no reason to do the bleeding time test. More than once.
I don't know what 1987 was about, but apparently they'd cut it. And I saw him. I saw that he had other ones, and he had the little blood things sitting. And then he drops the little blood. He puts a little like piece of crap on it, like a little looks like
a
litmus paper on the blood. Then he drops that. No,
this has got to be a bit. You're kidding me. He would cut your finger with a razor blade, and then you would dribble it on paper.
Yeah, just like a little like choop, and then put it in a little litmus thing, and he puts it in with like a little jar that was with like a million other little pieces of paper. So presumably he's doing this to all the kids, and I guess it's to save money because I feel that that's 100% cheaper way to take someone's blood.
It's probably
Keith,
cheaper
that's not
to take.
That's not a
blood
test. I don't know what to tell you. That's not a blood test.
Listen, Dad, I know you listen to this. What kind of pediatrician doctor are you sending me to?
The only time they would use a piece of paper would be for a glucometer, which they don't need anymore. But in the 80s, they would have. They would have taken a drop of your blood on a piece of paper and put it right away into a glucometer to check your diabetes.
As far as I know, he put it in a little jar. Maybe they were checking me for diabetes.
Yes, but if he mixed it in with a bunch of other blood in a jar...
No, not a bunch of other blood. He put it in like a from what I remember, I just remember that other kids had this taken, the situation from this doctor.
Mm-hmm. Again, if you didn't have juvenile diabetes,
which I did not,
there was no reason to do that for you every year.
But like my mom was diabetic, so maybe she was just always like, check them all the time.
Was your doctor in the church?
No. My doctor was... No. He was a very kind Jewish man named Dr. Can't remember his name. I was going to say Brazzo, but I think Dr. Brazzo was my dentist.
Did your dentist do this to you too?
No. Just my creepy doctor slashing open my finger all the time, and I hated it so much. Didn't care about the lollipops if they were slashing my finger open.
Yep, that's not a normal thing to do on an annual checkup.
That's wild.
I'm going to need to do more research.
You should.
Yep.
To discover. I was asking, I was like, did your doctors do it? I'm sure you must have because you're a little bit older than me.
No.
Nope.
Nope, never one time.
That's so crazy.
And I was still, in
I have, like, I have like a sensory, like a recoiling fear of just, it was a little like, choop.
Yeah, I can only think of getting blood tests when I stepped on a nail at a construction site and I needed to get tested for my, like, my vaccine status for my tetanus to see if it was up to date.
Yeah, no, I had pretty routine blood tests. And I, like I said, I don't remember being a really sickly kid, but I do remember those freaking razor blades cutting my finger open.
Yeah, they're called lancets.
I never had a blood test as a kid. Like, I mean, I really don't think I ever had blood drawn. Maybe like as a teeny tiny little child. But other than that, I don't think so. Not once.
Like I said, with my mom being diabetic, maybe she was being extra careful.
I mean, Archer's 10. He's had it done twice. Two blood tests. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, I don't know. I have no idea what they were possibly looking for. I was just, like I said, I was not even a sickly kid or anything. Meh. Mm. I'm going to Google this. I'm going to look this up and find out that this was a normal practice in the 80s. And I'll show you that my doctor wasn't just barbarically stealing blood from children.
They wanted to see what was in your system that made you want to watch Nightmare on Elm Street, Friday the 13th.
Maybe.
Doctor, test him for the devil. And he's like, ugh, fine. I'll put a bit of loose blood on a filter paper and we'll see if the devil's in there.
Yeah, we'll see if the devil's in there. If there was a like a horror movie doctor who had like a thing where you're like your hand was there and he was just like going at it and just like cutting the fingers of the razor blade, it would hit me on like such a visceral level. Like my fingertips are like recoiling right now at the memory of those stupid little razors. So if you just like amp that up to Saw level, I would be definitely like that would be a scene designed to just prey on my weird childhood trauma of having my fingers slap.
Hang on, let me get a pen. I gotta write this down.
Scott's making a horror film just for me.
Oh yeah, yeah, a film. That's why the camera's there.
Scott bringing visual humor to a podcast, always appreciated. I went to Texas, everybody.
And didn't get shot.
How was that?
I mean, I only saw, it was pretty great. I only saw, like I said, I think two guns the entire time, and they were on members of some private security. I saw cop cars. I didn't see tons of cops, like a fraction of the cops I saw in Florida when I was down in Florida last year. And like I said, the only guns I saw were holstered and with guys who were working security on kind of like the main strip area. And I was like, whatever, that's not, I don't like seeing guns at any time, but I was expecting more. I was expecting like going out and around in the city to see like a reasonable amount of holstered weaponry in a state where Austin.
Oh, Austin. Austin's like hippie Texas.
Austin is hippie Texas, but a lot of people are still pretty pro-gun in hippie Texas. Also, I learned what a moon tower is.
Is this a sexual position?
No, okay. it's not just a place to have a party because Kevin's parents didn't go away for the weekend. Mm-hmm. As from the film Dazed and Confused, right. We're doing the party up by the moon tower. So apparently it's a thing like prominent in Texas, but is in a lot of southern states because they were, tiny, tiny, small towns and a lot of ranches and stuff. They're just big, giant towers with huge lights on them. And apparently that was instead of street lights, because a lot of these towns, it wouldn't make sense to have street lights and they didn't have real epic grids. They would just build big old towers with lights on them so people could do stuff at night. And they were called moon towers. And there's still a few around Austin and Texas. There's like, I think 15 or 16 still active. We were like, hey, a moon tower. So I, despite the fact that knowing that there was a party on the, like party at the moon tower at, you know, in Dazed and Confused, a film I've seen like 100 times, I was always like, I don't know, maybe it's like a satellite dish or something. Nope. It's just a big, big old tower with a light on it.
It's like the reverse bat signal.
Exactly.
Shoots like down on the city.
Anyway, so yeah, moon towers, Scott, not a local thing, or not necessarily a local thing like in Dazed and Confused, like you said, like just our town has a moon tower. Moon towers all over Texas, and it was I guess all over the South by extension. So that was what I learned. Thanks, Texas.
It's weird.
It's not that weird.
I learned anything else? I learned in Dazed and Confused that Wiley Wiggins couldn't throw a baseball at all. So the fact that he was cast as the pitcher was very, very funny because he lied about it, not thinking that was actually going to be his entire scene in the movie. And that every time they show him throwing a pitch, it's from behind where they got some other kid wearing a wig to be the pitcher. Because he could not
must have been like so disappointed because Linklater loves baseball.
Yeah, and he's cast them, and they started filming already, and like the whole thing is going, and then they're like, "Here you go, kid. It's your pitching scene." And he's like, "Ugh.
Oh no!" Anyway, yeah, Austin was pretty fun. Food was good. Music was good. Live music scene is not a joke. They mean it. There's like you walk down their like main street, which is like 6th or Red River or South Congress, any of like their main streets, and like every single place has a band. Like every spot you go to has a band, and they're playing like usually a mix of covers and original tracks. Like we watched a couple sets of like bands that'll start off with like 2-3 covers to get you warmed up, throw in an original one, then another cover here and there, and then like their second half, their second act is almost all original music. So you can just like go anywhere and just watch bands. We went to go see
anything from the Austin scene. I'm trying to think
anything from the Austin scene, like who actually like came out of it.
Yeah,
I don't know. I mean, a lot of country. I'm sure a ton of country.
Yeah, was it all country that you were hearing in the bars?
A lot of obviously, like we tried to stick more to like blues, kind of like country blues and stuff. There was a lot of that, and there's a lot of like more like roots rock kind of stuff. Like thank goodness for bands like the Black Keys. Kind of like, you know, sound. I think are they from the Austin? I feel they definitely have an Austin-y sound. But yeah, we also went to go see we went to go see a Foo Fighters and a Tool cover band go back to back. It was like a cheap ticket on a Wednesday night. We're like, whatever. The Foo Fighters band they're called the Oof Fighters, and they were fun and fine. Like the most noticeable parts was that like the drummer was on time but like skipping a lot of parts, like the fills and stuff were not nearly as complicated. Like he never like screwed up the beat, but you're like, you are not Dave Grohl. But then the Tool cover band, which was called Learn to Swim, were unbelievable. Like like wildly talented, nothing skipped. Like Tool is complicated music. The singer had the full range of Maynard, sounded exactly the same. The bassist was like otherworldly on the bass, guitars were great, and like Sarah was like, oh, we'll watch the Tool band for like, and Sarah's a big Tool fan, was like, we'll watch it for like a song or two and then bounce. And then she was like, this is amazing. This is like you could close your eyes and you would very, very much be sure that Tool was playing on stage. I don't know why these guys are so talented and they're just wasting their time as a Tool cover band, because it's like a complicated band to cover. So if you're is it just that you can't write the music? Because if you can like play all of that music and you have that vocal range and everything else, you'd think you could put that together to be something original, at least from a talent perspective. But I'm like, none of these guys write songs? They're just really talented singers and musicians who can't write stuff?
Well, think how many talented costume designers there are who just make Stormtrooper outfits.
I guess.
Is that really hitting Maynard's range?
Yeah.
Maynard's got a hell of a voice.
The singer was unbelievable. Like I think Sarah took a couple clips. I'll have to play them for you at some point, but it was like all the stuff that you expect, like to be like, oh, he'll take like a shortcut here and just like make sure his voice doesn't crack. You're like, nope, wails in the entire thing.
crazy.
And he was wearing a skin tight, like muscles on the outside, like jumpsuit. Where I was like, well, you're doing, and the only one wearing anything weird. And I was like, also like Tool.
Was like, he also 5 foot two?
He was very short. Yeah,
Maynard's a little dude. Maybe it was Tool playing a show, but like as a cover band of themselves.
Because it was like the guitarist was like a big heavy dude, and the bassist was like an Asian guy. Right. So I don't think so. And the singer seemed to be pretty Latino. So, but was also a really short little dude. Yeah, I was blown away. Like we were like we grabbed the show. It was basically at like the Austin equivalent of like Foof's, right? It was like a total like gun. It used to be an old like car garage, literally, and then they just like painted everything black and threw a stage up in the corner, and they're like, it's a venue now. And so we were like, whatever, $10 for cover, and we're like, at least we'll know the songs. And then turned out to watch like a so-so Foo Fighters band and an unbelievable Tool cover band. Which was shocking.
Cool.
Yeah. Barbecue was great. If you like barbecue food, it was like traditional Texas style barbecue, in that it was like prepared like with smokers and rubs and marinating and all that stuff. But the seasoning was like Egyptian seasoning. So like, kind of like more like kofta style and like kubide and whatever else, but like all in like barbecue meats, and it was like blow your mind good. So that was exciting. And then, I mean, we talked about it in the email thread, but I think it's a great story. The Not a Damn Chance burger.
Mm-hmm. Explain.
So yeah, Philip Franklin Lee, who is like has two Michelin stars under his belt as a restaurateur, so like no stuff about food, decided to, he really likes a good cheeseburger. He teamed up with a pro skater whose name escapes me at this moment. But teamed up with a pro skater to be like, we're going to make a burger place, and it has the best cheeseburger you've ever had. Do we sell anything else? They're like, no, like you can get fries.
Mm-hmm.
That is all.
That's fair.
That's what you can get. There's also like a couple beers on tap, and they actually have like a limited cocktail menu. But like as food goes, you can order the best cheeseburger ever as per them and a side of fries. And that's the only food they serve whatsoever. And it's like, yeah, Wagyu beef, double cheeseburger with like a bit of their sauce on it, some pickles. Like it's nothing super jazzed up, just a really, really good cheeseburger. And yeah, and this woman came in and was like, I've been here before and this is a little undercooked, so like it wasn't like this last time and all that. And they're like, it's fine, we prepare every burger the exact same way. And the reason it has the name Not a Damn Chance, it's right on the thing. They were like customize your burger, : Not a Damn Chance. And that's like right there on the sign. And I was like, yeah, I can't imagine. Like, John, you hypothesized that she was trolling.
Yeah, it's called Not a Damn Chance. You kind of have to know. You go in there, that's what you're getting, you know, the thing on the menu.
The person that was with her like recoiled in such horror that she was even like suggesting like throw this back on the grill, it looks undercooked. Like the person, yeah, like went like white, like, oh my god.
I said it in the thread, Madonna. I'm second guessing myself. I don't think it was her, but there was like some famous type of human who went to
one of the Alamo draft houses.
Draft houses, yeah,
which is notorious for their anti-texting.
It was Madonna. Yep.
Yeah, and she pulls out her phone. It's like notorious. You get thrown out the second you pull your phone out. They don't even put up with that shit. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's not a work, but it's like a flex. You know, she's casting shade on the thing.
I guess
that wasn't her.
I don't know. It didn't seem to be. If it was meant to be a troll, maybe she backed off when the guy was like just unfazed. Like no, yeah. Like maybe she was hoping to get a rise out of him. And being like, you see the name or whatever, and like, maybe there are other people behind the counter who would flex that hard, mm-hmm, like back at that. But the guy was just like, no, we're not going to do that. It's fine.
Yeah,
and was just like, that was like his only answer. And she kind of dropped it really quickly. So I was kind of hoping that like she would keep pushing it, and he would go like Marshawn Lynch, like, no, we're not going to do that. It's fine. Just like every time she just keeps asking, just repeat the same line. Your food is getting cold, ma'am. We are not going to do that.
Did she eat that?
Anyway, huh?
She left. Sarah and I kind of like stuck around, and we were like talking to the chefs and stuff because we were in like the quiet part in the middle of the day. So they all seemed to be having a good time, and they were like,
Final question. What is a Wagyu beef burger run you? How much was this?
This was $16 American, so not bananas.
That's what a Notre Dame de Boeuf burger costs, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like, considering that a lot of, like, admittedly they're premium burgers with sides nowadays, but like a burger platter costs you $20 a lot of places.
And whatever, like, a Big Mac is $9.
Yeah, that's it. I found $16 to be borderline reasonable for a single. It is a single double cheeseburger, but it is like up there. Like I said, maybe recency bias, but like up there with like the best burgers I've ever had. Like, measurably delicious. And I was like the fact that like I don't think I've ever traveled to a place and like gone back to an eatery a second time in my like 1 week visit. But we were like 2 or 3 days later, we were like walking around the same part of town, and Sarah was like, can we get another burger? I was like, I was going to suggest that exact thing. Mm-hmm. So and yeah, I loved it. It was great. Awesome. It was fun. Would go again. Would consider moving there if it wasn't in America. if it was a city in Canada and not part of America, I would strongly consider living there because it was cool and chill. And it was kind of like, it was weird too, because it was like, it's where cowboys collide with hipsters, I guess. So you end up with like the rare, like, friendly hipster. Like, everybody's super friendly and they're not like snooty. You're like, oh, like you go to like a weird, like I was bummed out, like one of the weird like comic toy shops or whatever didn't have the Daniel Johnston "Hi, how are you" shirt in my size. But like the guy was like right away like, oh man, that's a bummer. Like, he's like, we're probably gonna get more because it's like South by Southwest next week, like if you come by, like whatever else. I was like, yeah, no, I'm only for the week. He's like, damn. Like, he wasn't just like, no, we don't have that, like, he jackass knew. Yeah, that's it. But he was just like just friendly, like easily could have been like, no, we don't have it, who cares. Like, everybody was just seemed into their thing. Like, we went to like an art shop, and immediately like looking at some of the art, like, oh, if you like this guy, you'll like this guy. Like, the helpful hipsters, which I'm so used to just like being like ignored and being like ignored at these like music shops or art stores or whatever. Well,
Austin is a city in flux, if I understand correctly. It's in the process of absorbing a whole bunch of spillover from Silicon Valley / San Francisco that's losing people. A whole bunch
of... Yeah, there's a lot of tech have come in. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, one of the people, like, almost all the barbecue places that you go to are kind of like counter spots, and then you just like grab a spot at a picnic table. So every time we like grab a barbecue, you're just kind of like sitting with people and getting to know them and talking to them too, which also you don't really get in Montreal. Just like chit-chatting with people at your table while you eat. It's not a
That's
thing.
That's pretty cool. Yeah.
I mean, you say that like it's pretty cool, but it also sounds nightmarish.
No. But at the same time too, like at some point of there, like a lot of people would just be like, oh, if I'm talking too much, like go enjoy your food. Like, they'll give you the out even. And you're like, no, it's fine. Or you could be like, yeah, thanks, bye. And then just like, then they disengage. Like, they were, like I said, I blew my mind at the friendly hipsters in Austin. Anyway.
Yep.
What else is up? That was the Austin. We learned about the Moon Tower and a bunch of food in Austin.
Oh, I did a little bit more. Go for it, John.
I actually got through half of the new Scott Pilgrim from Netflix, and you were actually right. It was, I can't believe it's like they fucking nailed it. I mean,
so good.
How else? I could see how it won't be enormous because it's really, really Scott Pilgrim perfectly, and which is going to have like a little bit of a narrower appeal than I don't know, fucking Hunger Games, not Hunger Games,
Squid Game,
and Hunger Games,
Squid Games, you know. But like, the tone of it was just like beyond perfect. It's like fully coolly mashed with like a comic dating thing, you know.
Yep. Yeah. So it's so good. And like Scott, have you watched one episode?
No, I just watched the trailer, but no one else here was really interested. So
are you going to watch an episode?
I mean, I love Scott Pilgrim. I'll get to
Can
it.
We spoil the first episode for you?
Is it based on the books?
No,
Well, it kind of goes a different way, and it's astonishing.
So, like, the big spoiler is the first episode is basically the first comic.
Okay.
Like, almost like beat for beat. We've all seen the movie. We've all read the comics and everything else. And you're just sort of like, okay, they just made a little anime of the comic, and it's fine. And I didn't know anything about it. And now here's the spoiler that Scott is what makes you worth it to watch alone is it's Jay Patel. Patel?
Something Patel.
He wins the fight and like punches and Scott vanishes. And everyone's like, I guess Scott's dead.
And that's it.
And that's how the first episode ends.
Huh.
And then you're like, what? And then, like, it's still all the same characters who are still kind of going through the motions of the events of Scott Pilgrim, but, like, without Scott Pilgrim. Hence why it's called Scott Pilgrim Takes Off, because he loses the first fight. So that's what I'm saying. It's worth watching because it's not just a retelling of the books. It's a parallel universe to the events of the books.
With the full voice cast from the movie. And they're all knocking it out of the park. It's like,
Like every single person is back on the voice cast, like from Aubrey Plaza to Anna Kendrick, like even like smaller roles and stuff they're all there.
Yeah. They go into a little bit more detail about the Legion of Evil Exes, just like ever so slightly enough. So you feel like you kind of like get a better sense of it. I don't know if I'm misremembering the comics. It's been a really long time, but like, I kind of remember it as just being this weird thing, you know, that doesn't really get explained. And they spend just like a tiny amount of time in the Legion Hall or whatever their base is called, like having a little interaction between them.
Yeah. I don't think they ever interact in the comics. Like, they get their backstories and stuff explained, but they're never, like, you never see, like, the seven of them, like, hanging out and having a Legion of Doom moment or, like, conversation.
Yeah, which they do in the show. Like, and oddly, the kind of downtime moment that those characters get allows them to become just, like, a little bit more, it's not believable, but it's, like,
you understand them a little bit more.
Yeah.
Like,
in a weird way, it's like how what's it called in Blues, Kung Fu, Cowboy Bebop. In Cowboy Bebop, you got like a little bit more downtime with the characters, and it expanded them, and it let their ridiculousness have a little normal space aside it to be more approachable. I don't know. I'm kind of astonished at how good a job they did with this show. I'll admit I haven't finished it. I'm like halfway through, so there's plenty of time to lose steam or whatever. But
I mean, hang on a sec.
Before we get any
six
further,
episodes, eight episodes.
Yeah, six, I think.
Before we get further with this, I want to touch on what John's two choices were to pull Cowboy Bebop from his head. Blues Kung Fu, amazing, perfect. He's like, you know that show, Blues Kung Fu.
I mean,
no, it's great.
Close.
I love it. It was amazing. I'm not raining on your parade here. I was just like, yeah.
That to be fair, I went Samurai Champloo first, but you know, Cowboy Bebop gets there also. Mm-hmm. Scott Pilgrim's real fun. Scott, you were saying.
I did a little more voice acting today. I'm trying to get a spot on the X-Men podcast.
Who are you trying out for in the X-Men podcast?
I auditioned for two roles, one of the Morlocks and one of the Marauders in Sunder and Blockbuster. So just little roles.
I do not know these characters.
Well, you know the Morlocks.
I know them. I know of the Morlocks.
Okay. So Sunder is like the big muscle bound kind of childish guy, and Blockbuster is also the big muscle-bound guy who kills a lot of the Morlocks.
Nice. Don't typecast yourself, big muscle-bound guy.
I mean, yeah, I don't want to, but I mean, I'm trying out for some Russian guys on the Avengers podcast too. I got some auditions floating out there.
Just tapping into Anton.
Just a little bit, yeah. Red Guardian and Crimson Dynamo, Abomination.
Oh man!
Because I'm getting typecast as the muscle guy, I'll probably get Abomination.
Nice. I'm now. I think I have six issues of the Hickman run before the world ends. I've read so many comics, dude. It's so weird. Everything is weird. And I know it's going to the Secret Wars. And I found a list of like the best Secret War series to read. So I will probably read like some of them. Because I've heard, like you said, like the zombies versus 1602 or whatever the hell it is. Like there's like some good
Age
stuff.
Of Ultron versus Marvel Zombies kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Like those seem fun. Like, yep. I think I agree. I think we talked about it on the show. And I was pissed off when it happened to me just reading through Guardians of the Galaxy. I would just be so mad of like, all the comics you read are over. Here's some random bullshit. Go! And you're like, what? We're going to do this for like a year. And then things will go back to normal. Ballsy, in a way. Like,
I mean, is it, or is it just desperately trying to catch up to DC with the New 52 and...
Yeah, but like, the New 52 at least was like a hard reset. They were like, let's do a year of random bullshit before we do the hard reset. Like,
yeah, but they had Countdown like, before that. Countdown was a full year, a comic a week for 52 weeks. And then...
Yeah. But I mean, the incursion stuff is like 4 years building, slowly seeping into everything. And that could have been the like... what do you call it? Like, the incursion point or whatever the hell happened could have also just reset it to a single timeline or whatever the hell, and then just moved on from there. The fact that they threw in like hundreds of issues of Secret War nonsense for no reason. That's the part that blows my mind.
God. And so many of them just fucking bizarre.
Apparently there's a Mad Maxy one. So I want to do that. There's like a car combat planet. And I was like, sold. Ghost Rider's involved.
One of them is a planet of E for Extinction. E for Extinction was the Grant Morrison X-Men run.
Oh.
It just goes back to that. It's like Hickman relaunching Morrison. Weird.
What did he invent the weird like Justice Society? Because it was like there's several issues during the incursion where there's...
Huh? No, that stuff is like the Ultraman and Superwoman and Power Ring.
No.
The evil.
No. They're really, really good. They're like an alternate reality. They appear to kind of be like pastiches of like, of clearly the Justice League. There's like the Saul or whatever, like the Man of the Sun and all that. And there's kind of a Batman guy, but he's a knight and whatever, but it's
do
just
mean,
like,
do you mean they're the around authority?
The
Authority, Apollo and Midnighter and,
No, because it's during the incursion buildup. It's like it's a universe that they're colliding into, and I guess it's just like a weird thing that Hickman decides to do, which is basically these are the DC heroes, and they're so much more like pure and good than the Marvel heroes that they were like, we would never destroy another planet. We use all of our resources to bypass the incursions, and you guys are terrible people. And they're like, uh-oh. Are we the villains all along? And then the Marvel heroes end up killing like the goody two shoes, like Justice Society, who's been doing everything super heroically to prevent the universes from crashing into each other.
Awesome.
Because at the end of the day, Reed and Tony and Banner are all shitheads.
Yep. I mean, true. Where's the lie?
Exactly. That's why it was like, it was a good bit. I was like, and I'm surprised they stuck with it for a few issues to be like, hey, your heroes are sometimes really terrible. And now they've just run into 1616 is Ultimates.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They ran into 1616 Reed Richards, who is the worst.
Oh yeah. Yeah. He's the actual villain of the Ultimate Universe.
Yeah, exactly. That's it.
Man, Ultimate. Did you ever read Ultimatum?
I never read Ultimatum though. I only read the beginning of the Ultimates run and then Ultimate Spider-Man. I did a good chunk of, and I haven't done.
So like the best of the Ultimate Universe.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Everybody else told me they were like, it was a good idea that they then ran with too far. So they were like, stop now.
Ultimatum might be the worst Marvel comic ever made.
What? Explain Ultimatum like I'm five.
Ooh, I'm trying to think of
it. It takes place in the Ultimate Universe.
Takes place in the Ultimate Universe. Magneto has killed everyone in New York City.
As you do.
And
why?
Because they're not made of magnets.
How do they work?
Okay.
They kept asking him, how do magnets even work? It just was like, enough.
I mean, I guess they like Ultimate Magneto is very like about culling humanity and
yeah, full on terrorist. Bullet. You will stop killing mutants or I will kill your city. And they're like, oh, you don't tell us what to do. And he's like, oh, well, fuck you, I'll kill your
city. Okay, then. Right. That was really it.
So the Avengers and the X-Men attack him and the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants and blah blah blah. Jeff Loeb goes fucking crazy.
And as only Jeff Loeb can.
Yeah, at one point the blob just, you know, eats the wasp. Like, not little wasp, like full-grown body on the floor, just in the middle of the battle, stops and starts to cannibalize her. He's like, what? I was hungry.
Amazing.
It's real bad. It looks like it's all drawn by Liefeld. Like, it's just, it's crazy and bananas and awful. Yeah,
that sucks. Because I was gonna say, I was like, if Jeff Loeb going fully crazy, you got to have the art to back it up, like Red Hulk. Like Red Hulk.
Yeah. It is not that.
Jeff Loeb going bananas in Red Hulk with just some of the best splash pages and comic arts are just absolute Marvel hosses throwing down and punching everything.
Yeah, Red Hulk punching Thor so hard he hits the moon. That's great.
That happens in after the weird in one of the incursion splits. Once when Captain America finds out about what the Illuminati's doing, because they kick him out of the Illuminati and erase his mind because he is too good. And they're like, mm-hmm. Uh-oh. After he finds out, then they end up kind of like splitting off. There's like the Illuminati and then the Shield Avengers. Captain Marvel's on Shield Avengers and Hulk is on Illuminati at this point. And there's like they're kind of scrambling and having this fight, whatever. And like Danvers is like punching Hulk again and again and again. There's like multiple pages of cutting away, and finally like you turn the page and it's just sort of like, and then Hulk just kind of like grins and he's like, "You done?" And you see like, poof, and you just see like Danvers flying out, and they're just sort of like they're like Danvers is like left the area, whatever else like that. They're like, "Where is it?" They're like, "Low atmosphere. Going to be a few minutes before she's back." It's like Hulk just punched her into orbit.
It's great.
I was like, it's the best. Also, there's one of my favorite lines of dialogue so far that I've read was, so Tony Stark has essentially at this point burned the bridges of everybody because he's Tony Stark and he's trying to try not to kill universes, but ultimately is kind of killing universes, and all of his friends go. Anyway, so Black Widow and Spider-Woman find him in his super secret prison that he's being held by Thanos and the Cabal and all that stuff. And he's like, are you here like representing the half of my friends who like want to kill me, or like the half of my friends who hate me for what I did? And they're like, oh, Tony, your mistake is thinking you have any friends at all right now. He was like, I used to have friends. Good old Tony Stark. Oh. Have you guys read, or more importantly, seen the photos of the Glasgow Wonka experience?
Like Willy?
Yes? Question mark.
No, I have not seen any of this.
Oh my goodness, it's the best.
I've told you this story before. Like Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory is nightmare fuel from my childhood.
Why?
Is it like a doctor slashing your finger open?
I went to go see this movie with my father at Cinema 5 on Sherbrooke and had to leave the movie because I threw a hysterical tantrum at the body horror that is included in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Right. I feel like we've talked about this on the show, that I think that Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory is absolutely like a gateway film into like, for horror fans. Mm-hmm. Like if you're a little kid and you're like, I like the way this makes me feel, like everything is crazy and weird, you're like, yeah, you like horror movies, kid, that's what you're talking about.
Like, she stole one Willy candy Wonka like
that, he's so weird.
She stole one candy and got turned into a giant blue balloon girl.
Yeah, Willy Wonka's like could be is Freddy Krueger for kids.
Yeah, like, that's it exactly.
Anyway, so in yeah. Scotland, there was a weird company unaffiliated with the movie, but obviously like a cash grab to the Wonka film or whatever. They decided to have like it's being described in the news as Firefest for children.
God,
like it's just like an empty warehouse, like a cardboard cutout of like a what do you call it, a rainbow. Apparently, the kids got a single jelly bean. And there was not even any candy for purchase. It was just sad people. Like, the actors were given scripts that were clearly, like, generated by AI. Like, just rambling, like completely rambling insanity. The people, like, the actors have put the scripts up on the internet to show, like, what scripts they got. They were just everybody rushing through. And they charged, like, 35 British pounds to, like, a person to get into this thing. And it's just an empty warehouse with maybe 6 decorations inside. And, like, some... the ugliest Oompa Loompa costumes you've kind of ever seen. And the bad guy is the Unknown, which is an evil man who lives in the walls and is trying to steal the chocolate. But there is no chocolate because you can't even buy any chocolate. It's just the saddest. And like the actor who was playing Willy Wonka was like, I was promised like a 15-minute break basically almost like every hour of like, so like 45 full minutes in character, like nonstop acting. And then like, 15 minutes while the Oompa Loompas like prep the next tour or whatever it is. And he's like, so like after 4 hours, I finally got my first break. And he's like, I just went into my car and I stared at the floor because if I looked outside of my car anywhere, I just saw children crying. There was nothing I could do to like make it better. And I was trying my best because I was like, as Willy Wonka, I was like the one guy that could like, if I gave it my all, like if I gave it my all, at least the kids could maybe have some enjoyment. And there's footage of him. He's trying. Like, he's really, really trying. Anyway, they shut the whole thing down after one day, and, like, the organizers, which were called the Illuminati, which is just weird. The organizers were like, we should have realized in the morning that it was never going to work.
Good Lord.
Okay, but they obviously didn't put any money into it. Like, it was obviously a work from the
beginning. They claim that they didn't receive, like, props that they had ordered or whatever else, and like had done like misunderstood the size of some of the props that they did order and all that stuff. But yeah, but like
they were like, we knew the size of some props. It's like fucking yeah. Spinal Tap. This is Stonehenge.
Exactly. that's exactly what I was thinking. I'm like, okay. Whatever. There's a picture of the absolute saddest looking Scottish woman in Oompa Loompa costume, just looking completely like defeated, like leaning on a counter with like a couple bubbling potions like in front of her.
Good Lord.
It's very funny.
Were the Oompa Loompas all weeb folk?
No, they were just, I think, shorter than average people. Mm-hmm. Maybe. Like they probably just cast like 5 foot tall girls or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, yeah, it's very funny. Some of the pictures are great. And the script is bananas. Like, the script is like, really appears to be, like, you asked an AI to, like, write a weird Willy Wonka story. Anyway, at least apparently they refunded everybody and cut their losses, and they didn't actually fly them out to an island and just throw them into tents to experience this.
Speaking of AI, did you see or hear about the... lawsuit that's being filed in the States by the New York Times against Microsoft and OpenAI?
I mean, I could see it coming, especially with the New York Times, because their stuff is behind a paywall.
I have, yes. Mm-hmm. I've been following this intimately. What have you heard?
The fact that they're going after every single case of skimming, which has a maximum... maximum charge of $150,000, and they're just like, well, these two AI bots have done it hundreds of thousands of times, so each one of them is a single case that we're going after for. So we're talking billions of dollars here, and the precedent is that they are arguing that it's not going to fall under fair use of training the AI bots on all of their content, because the ultimate result is still going to be the same of informing the end user of the knowledge. So they're like, if you take our article and our research and our study, and then you tell it to someone as like, hey, this is the answer you're looking for. That's what the newspaper does. So you do not license this article. You cannot just take it and give it to your AI and have the AI spit it out as if they did all the work.
Yeah, so they write, the AIs write it, you know, they can spit out verbatim what the text was from the articles. So there's like, there's that. There's the argument that says, well, you know, if you're teaching a person something, what they do is they read it and they interpret it and they give it back, which is like, survives only the most superficial scrutiny, right? Like these, the AIs can, you know, they never forget. They can they can reassess the same data over and over and over again and regurgitate it exactly word for word ad nauseum. Like, it's so crazy. And the OpenAI within the last couple of months has like hemorrhaged talent. You know, they were enormous in the news all of a sudden. They got this crazy partnership with Microsoft. Microsoft is using their some of their work is being used to fuel Copilot. I don't know if you've heard anything about that.
Yeah. That's like the virtual assistant or whatever that is. Or
yeah,
like,
you can ask it to help you write code, and then it'll give you kind of code frameworks. Now,
yeah, Copilot is plugged into Power BI too, I want to say. Is that the one that's plugged into Power BI?
Probably is. I use Power BI every day of my life, but I actually haven't worked too much with the Copilot plugin to the side of it. The thing that's crazy is that Copilot, I might be misremembering which one it is, but I'm pretty sure that it's Copilot that went through everything on GitHub, stripped off all of the licenses from it, and then allows you to regurgitate exact code off of everybody's GitHub code, which is pissing off all kinds of open source people who put stuff on there only with the express purpose that if you used the code, then you would have to give it the same attribution. It's like part of the license.
So, yeah, it's like a Creative Commons license.
Yeah, there's an enormous, well, yeah, that's one of them. There's a bunch that offer different degrees of to translate it. Anyway, there has been an enormous amount of overreach with the AI companies grabbing data and fueling it into themselves. And there's an argument that says, hey, if we all benefit from it, it'll be great. But of course, we know we're going to be monetized to receive any of those benefits. And so it's like, they have to defend themselves. We should kind of be on the New York Times' side in this particular battle.
Well, I feel that almost any side versus like restrictions and lawsuits against AI, I'm kind of on the side that is taken on the AI. Like,
well, the reason
I cannot imagine a technology that I'm more scared of than like AI machine learning.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of war machine technology I'm more scared of than.
Yeah, but now think of that war machine technology in the hands of an AI, and it's scarier.
A lot of newspapers.
It's like the top end benefits are huge, but like I don't trust the people. I don't think we're going to go Skynet and it's like, oh no, it became self aware and that's the problem. It's like, but to John's point, it's the how they're going to monetize this, make it shitty, drive people out of jobs. It's like the corporations that are going to be controlling the AIs are going to be much, much, much worse than the Skynet AI that people are like scared of.
Yeah.
A lot of newspapers have already signed like license agreements with these companies. Mm-hmm. So they're just like, we don't have the time or energy to fight this. So just scrape us off a little bit and we'll leave you alone. But the Times is notoriously litigious. So they're just like, well, fuck it. Let's go. And I'm kind of here for that.
Yeah. The other side is that you don't have a choice. Your stuff goes online, it's getting absorbed into a whole bunch of AI stuff.
Yeah, but that's what I was going to say, though. What's weird about that is that, like, you can make the argument of the Times that, like, everything is on the Times is, like, behind a paywall, right? So you're saying that, like, yeah, you get, like, what, five free articles on the Times a month if you don't have a subscription?
Really?
Yeah.
There's a link, though. You go archive.is, and then you just look at whatever.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying.
Or you take the newspaper and just scan it in.
Right.
Yeah, I'm saying that there are ways about it, but it's just the New York Times is going to say that is theft because the only way to legally obtain it is to go through our paywall or to buy the newspaper. So, like, the fact that they're not putting the content...
Their lawsuit isn't about the theft. Their lawsuit is about the republication.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying. It's like...
That these AIs are bypassing the firewall, the paywall.
Yeah, they care about the fact that you could say, tell me what that New York Times article said yesterday, and it'll be like, blah, 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 blah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. And they can just say that we never made that freely available. So you have to pay us for it all the time. So if you read it for free, it's fine. Mm. If you try to put it online for free, that's a problem.
It's not even, it's the idea of fair use. Mm-hmm. Like, we can read an article and talk about it.
Yeah.
But where our fair use is the editorialization that we would offer to.
And we would probably cite the article. Call me crazy.
Would we, though? How often do we cite anything on this show?
I mean, if we really read something from something, we usually do. If we just, yeah. If we half remember something, which, like, again, is like what Scott said, is editorializing. But if we, like, read a passage verbatim, we'll usually be like, this is from this website.
I mean, that it's an important part of the argument. We're going to fuck it up pretty badly and obviously give pretty like mediocre interpretation of it, which might be bad for the New York Times, but also might be good for them because they're going to come off looking really, really erudite compared to our half-remembered references to it, you know, which
is not article in the New York Times in, like, I don't know, I want to say grade 10. Anyways, I went about something or other. Boy.
Yeah. Journalism. It was interesting, I swear. Huh, how about that? Articles.
Remember newspapers? Yeah, that's it. I that's what I'm saying. It's like, I don't... How do you not, I guess, like, fear when to go back to last week's word of the week, and shitification, mm-hmm. you know, and then you think of something like a service and a concept as powerful as, like, machine learning AI, and you're like, oh, they're gonna make it so bad. They made mm-hmm. Netflix so bad. that was just the video streaming platform.
Are we sure that it's AI content that made Netflix bad rather than just shitty?
No. I'm saying the concept of enshittification made Netflix bad. Like, the corporation of Netflix, like, took a core concept and then chopped it up and over monetized and then, like, inserted their own algorithm so you couldn't even find the crap that you wanted, which maybe was AI or their own algorithm or whatever, and you're just sort of like, they had a good thing and they ruined it because they wanted to make it shittier to make more money or whatever. And
I think Netflix was making all of this money, and Disney and Peacock and Paramount were all just like, wait, why are they making all the money on our shows?
It's true.
Let's not do that. Let's us make all the money on our shows.
And now we'll just have cable, but it'll be the internet. Get out of here.
Exactly. No, I mean, you can say how much you don't like it, but if I was an executive of NBC and I was watching, you know, fucking Seinfeld sell for $1 billion to Netflix, it's just like, wait, why don't I
own Seinfeld?
Why don't we just sell Seinfeld? Why do we have to fucking give it to Netflix to make them the money?
Also, media companies. Remember those? I was reading I read a...
You mean Disney?
What the hell happened with Shane Smith?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Vice is dead, eh? We could talk about that. Vice.
I think we talked about it when they declared bankruptcy and sold it off for parts. And they were just like, it was basically, they were like the last deal that Shane Smith ever brokered. Which was still kind of amazing. Apparently, like, the article was really diving in. I forget what he actually got when he sold off the pieces for parts. Like, but it was evaluated at like three. The Vice Media was valued at like $3 billion just like a couple years prior. Like, yeah. Rupert Murdoch wanted to buy him out for like $2 million and like $2 billion, I should say, in like 2007 and whatever else.
What did he get for it in the end?
He ended up getting a couple million dollars, but like the article was kind of like, because Shane Smith is like a complete hustler who just like gets into your ear and just can talk up anything. And the article was like, it's amazing that he got that. They were really? Like, he was essentially like selling garbage and still convinced people to give him millions of dollars.
I don't understand that's possible. Like, the back content of Vice, there's like shitloads of good articles from 20 years,
yeah.
95 to 15, maybe.
Yeah, but what is dated content? And apparently that was like the big thing, that like overvalued and then undervalued Vice, right? Which was that it was like, or undervalued and then overvalued. I don't know, whatever the point is. Like, mm-hmm. how they could make it for so cheap and then get that big media empire. And then everyone was like, oh, this is worth so much. And then like with the rise of, I guess, like TikTok and everything else, they were like, a guy on YouTube is making Vice content and that people are just getting for free. Why are they going to pay for it from Vice? Like, yes, the Vice content is curated and it's high caliber, but there's now like there's now those video essay guides and stuff on YouTube. Like, they're not all of them. There's a whole lot of trash on YouTube.
It's like 99.999% trash.
But yeah, but the really good stuff is almost like indecipherable from a cool Vice documentary. You know, like,
I mean,
like
I have really YouTube on my TV and it gets equal play with Amazon and Disney. Because there's stuff there that I want to watch.
So you're like, so it's, that's what leads to an overvaluation, I think. And then all of it gets dated. And then everybody else is just, all of the content is so different and consumed. I think they did great work, but there's no way that you can tell me that Vice was ever really worth $3.2 billion.
Probably right? Like, not.
Yeah. Like probably maybe a couple, maybe a couple million, maybe a couple hundred million, you know, like as a video catalog, like what did Ring of Honor, Tony Khan bought Ring of Honor for like $50 million or whatever. Like that was the entire video library of a wrestling like company that had been around for like 15 years. He bought every single second of their video. 30 years. Yeah. He bought every single second of their back catalog for like $50 million. You can't tell me Vice is going to drive up to $3.2 billion. You know, like anyway, it's kind of interesting. And but yeah, sad.
Yeah,
I still have a couple little copies of Vice kicking around my bathroom, and I flip through them, and I'm like, man, what a cool little magazine! Totally. And then it was a cool website, like, and they did cool documentaries.
A little eulogy for Vice. I don't know if now is the time, but I think we could put together a good one. There were some articles in there that were fucking hilarious, front to back, and like deep at the same time. Gross Jar was funny, fucking. Do's and don'ts were like nonstop hilarity. Some of the Vice travel stuff was incredible. Mm-hmm. The Vice drugs stuff was incredible. The one.
Yeah, one of the issues I have kicking around in my bathroom is like the entire issue, like back to front, is like Vice goes to South Sudan, and you're like, oh wow.
I think that's what Vice did though. They were ready to take a look at talent from young people that no other news or media agency was doing at all 15 years ago. They were just like, you wouldn't get an ABC news special from like very talented, driven people who were 22 years old.
Yeah, you just send Tom Brokaw or whatever.
Yeah, and they would do it and they would calculate it and they'd say, okay, this will get 2 minutes of Nightline time and go.
Yeah.
So Vice was able to like, one, take those risks because those people were not getting paid a lot, and they would own that content fully and completely. They're like, this is a Vice story, and we've paid this person $5,000 and a trip to Sudan.
Oh boy!
But the person was also talented, even though they might have been inexperienced enough in terms of realizing what the value of the content they were creating was. Because there was a cool
factor.
I find
it genuinely sad. I think that, you know, I read a huge article talking about how esports never delivered on the promise, right?
Yeah.
So there was a point like 10 or 15 years ago where there was a huge amount of excitement, shitload of money went in, everybody got really excited. You know, people were pitching it as, okay, esports is going to be like sports. And it never absolutely did. If, you know, there's a ton of different reasons, but people put money into it believing the dream that it could be, you know? Yeah. And so absolutely absurd expectations that it never could have in a million billion years have lived up to fueled the money. And I think it's the same thing with Vice, you know, like there was just too much money thrown at it. It never could possibly repay it. And the efforts to extract cash to make back that revenue are poison, you know?
Yeah.
And shitification.
Yeah. And that's it. I mean, like, I think that like Vice was being pitched as like, it's going to be like CNN for young people or whatever. Like, it's going to be this whole thing that's going to be a monster brand. It's going to be like synonymous with the news. And I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah.
I watched all of Shoresy also.
Oh, it's so good. It's fucking brilliant.
Unbelievable.
Is it?
Unbelievable. John, did you not watch any of it?
I didn't watch any of it. I remember you guys talking about it last week.
Oh my God.
Oh, yeah.
It's such a victory. That's my favorite thing about it too, is it doesn't leave you feeling shitty. Like there's things that happen and you're just kind of like, these characters are evolving and changing. But, oh my God. Is it nice to root for someone and just kind of like have things go okay.
Yeah. Just a bunch of good dudes who have a little bit of adversity, like overcome that adversity and grow a little bit as people. But while simultaneously being like the funniest pack of assholes in the world.
and gearing up for the next challenge.
Yeah. Oh my God. In the season two finale, where as the relationships that they form are all like showing up one by one to the rink as they're right. playing against the United States. Every guy on the team, when his like girlfriend or you know significant other shows up, like there's a highlight reel goal that he scores. When Shorzy's girl shows up, he just spears a guy in the dick.
Gotta set the tone, boys.
Gotta set the tone. We'll never lose again. It's so good.
The scene where Schnurr shows up and fixes the showers, and Nat leans over her desk and white knuckles and just stares at the camera, watery-eyed. So I'm going to fuck that slut. Was the hottest scene in television I've ever seen. I watched it was like 2:30 in the morning and I just felt a chill go down my spine being like, good God.
She's going to fuck that slut. All the women execs call all the hockey players sluts. It's great. It's
like... the stuff with Shorzy's family, it's so good.
Yeah. Like Shorzy's family's great. Just the
he's from a foster family, and at no point is him being a foster kid at all used an excuse for him being such a dickhead. Because his family's the best.
The rest of his siblings are so much more well adjusted and friendly, and like, and the dad is Scott Thompson. Like, that's great.
And the dad is probably the source of him being kind of a dick because he's kind of a dick too.
It also kind of implies. I mean, like, I also love that he you have no idea what his real name is. Like he clearly took his foster dad's name, yep. right? Because it's like it's the Shore House. But I was like, but then Sarah was like, what if it's just the Shore House? And that's not even his foster dad's name. Like, it's just like a house on the shore. And that's like the name of the foster house. So he does not have a name. He's just the kid from Shore's house called Shorzy. So he does not have a name at all. Like, because it's just like everybody calls him Shorzy and the name on the back of the jersey is just Shore. And then you see like the foster house was like the Shore House family reunion. But like we were saying, that might not be like Scott Thompson's character's last name. That might just be like the name of the foster house is like Shore House. So he may not even have a real name. Good old Shorzy.
Oh,
that's great. Like I said, there was one thing that had, the cokehead. Like when he's chirping the cokehead, he just at a certain point, there's like a cokehead on the other team who's just completely run down because he got into it in Sudbury.
How do you know, Zig? Because I was there. Exactly. How do you know that, Zig? Because I was there.
Keeps cutting back. Like it's like a girl selling. It's like I saw him at the club, whatever. It's like that, and like how do you know that? And it's like because I was there. And he's panning over, and she's like there doing the same thing. Like he's doing rails, cuts over. She's doing rails. They go to the champagne room. She's in the champagne room next to him. Like they go back to the stripper's house. She's back at the stripper's house. Like,
God damn it, Zig.
When he goes like this, but if like he's like. On the stick and he like pops a little bit of like snow up on the stick, like just like along the blade. And he's like, Hey, what does this remind you of? Like, I don't know why. Like of all the chirps about him doing blow that just cracked me up. I was like, that's so perfect. I will say that season two lacked the amount of refereeing chirps that season one had that I missed out. Making fun of the kids was not as integral in season two as it was in season one.
They replaced it with lots of lingerie models.
They did.
Lots of lingerie models in season two. Like an uncomfortable amount.
There's an impossible number of hot-looking women in Sudbury. Everybody just keeps repeating it.
Including Jay Onright.
Including Jay Onright, yeah. But there's like a framing like news, like sports news device coming in and out, and they're just sort of like, why does anyone go to Sudbury? And John Wright's like, well, there's an impossible number of good-looking women in Sudbury.
And then the show cuts to, like, actual Sudbury women's Instagram accounts, just one after the other after the other. Pop, 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 pop. Oh, man, Shoresy makes me so happy.
It's like, very funny.
I got to check it out. What is it on?
Crave.
Crave, officially.
Okay. Gotcha.
Crave. And it's 20-minute episodes.
Six episode seasons.
Like you'll crush through it. Just.
I would do so many of your chores. I would make your life so easy.
I would walk 2 miles just to unload your dishwasher.
You know what I was doing last night? I was watching YouTube videos on how to give you the best foot massage. He's basically like, for 2 seasons, he's just like, there's like the reporter in town, and he's just saying like the sweetest possible things to her, like never sleazy, like never ever sleazy. The best is he was just sort of like, he's like she's like saying something, and he's like, have you ever been so enamored with somebody that when they're talking, like the little voice inside of you is just going, yay!
It's the so scene good. Where she's interviewing him for a quote, and she walks away and she's like, what do you say about me to the boys? And he like tells her, you're smart, you're clever, you're kind, you're brilliant. And she just looks back at him like, Shoresy? Are you okay?
Like, yeah, that's God your locker room talk to the boys.
Oh, you're crazy. Laura Moore is the hottest girl in Sudbury, you idiot. Huh. Oh, hey, Laura. Can you believe that, idiot?
Also, the best is like she's an older actress. Like she's like clearly like in her like 40s or whatever else. And it's just like every other like hot chick, they're like, how about that piece on that, Shoresy? And he's like, little young for my taste. Like every other woman in the show, he's like,
give it 15
too
years.
Young for my blood. Like, and then the no-show execs.
Oh my god, that was the best.
The no-show execs are like three indigenous women who are like in their 60s, and he's like, they are so hot. and they're like,
the team president is like, you will say nothing. You will say nothing to them. This whole disciplinary action meeting you're going to, you do not open your mouth. And he's just standing there taking it, and they're ripping him. And as soon as it starts to go against them, one of the team management people is like, Shoresy thinks you're hot. And all three of them are like, really? which one of us? And he kind of just, his eyes go wild, and he's like, all of you, all three of you. And they totally don't suspend him. It's great.
I love where he's just sort of like, he's like, what would you do if I like took you home with me? And he's just sort of like, I would go find your husband and shake his hand.
So great. Shoresy is so good.
Like the most respectful answer you could get while telling the woman that she's hot. Like, yeah, good times. Recommend highly. And I got Sarah to buy in on one episode. I was like, babe, you could do, because she hated Letterkenny. I thought Letterkenny was so. I thought it was, like I said, a little, little too.
Oh no! I got it.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just saying. And then I was like, and I heard Shoresy was like a step up above it. And I was like, okay, let's do one episode of Shoresy. And we like watched, I think, the first 3 or 4 episodes in one night. She was like, I'm down. I love this show. And she was like, I'm so sad that it's over. And I was like, yes. I was like, I would absolutely watch it without you. But it's, you know, it's always fun. Also,
I noticed an Easter egg in the last episode.
An Easter egg?
Yeah, just a tiny, like, fucking, it's the most neurotic thing I've ever done looking at a TV show. Just as he goes into Laura Moore's house for the first time, I sent you a picture of it just now. If you pick up your phone, you can take a look at it. There is a reflection in the glass.
Visual humor, Ian.
No, I'm describing it. There's a reflection in the glass of the door that reflects on some kids' art on the inside of her house that you never see and never could see. And if you zoom
you never
in
see
on
the
it,
kids.
It's a picture. It's a drawing of like a 8-year-old kid's drawing of Shoresy, that her kid is a fan of him, And it just made my heart just go, oh. She never admits to that. And you never see the kid. But like in her house is a picture that her kid drew of the guy that's been politely
hitting on her for 2 years. Yep. I also love when what's his name? When the goalie is talking about like American players.
Fucking Michaels. Shut up.
Shut up, Michaels. And he was just sort of like, he's like, game over, man. He's like, McKinnon, Crosby, and McDavid. And it's just sort of like, any three, whatever else like that. And he's like, yeah, but what about like the Kachucks and all that stuff? And he's sort of like, I didn't even mention the player that if you ask all three of those guys who the best player is, they'll all say Cale Makar. I was like, deep. Sarah was like, what? And I was like, everybody hockey podcast, Cale Makar is the best player in the world. But nobody knows it.
There's something like, it's also that it's so crazy progressive without really even trying to be like,
yeah, like they're all super macho meatheads that are just, it's all about like camaraderie and treating women right.
That, but also one, there's like
a ton of indigenous cast,
a huge amount of indigenous cast, racially diverse cast. Nothing is said of that aside from saying tough natives is redundant.
Yeah,
that's the only line. We need to get some tough natives on this team. Saying tough natives is redundant. That's the only time it ever becomes an issue. Two, they have to go to a fundraiser at a gay bar. And the only issue.
It's not just the gay bar. It's the calendar. When Shorzy shows up for the calendar. Well,
the calendar's great.
Yeah.
I just thought some nice ladies would want to see us with their tarps off.
Yeah, exactly. Why do you have a spray tan? Well, if I was a lady and I wanted to buy a calendar, I'd expect them to have a spray tan. Just like, well, if I was a lady and I was buying a calendar, I'd expect them to
be greased up.
Yeah, exactly. Who's going to grease me up in the bathroom? If I'm going to buy a calendar of a bunch of hockey players, I'd expect them to be greased up.
And that is just
the rest of you. Get some spray tan. Take those tarps off. We'll grease each other up. It's going to sell calendars.
God, I love that Nat and Shore have such a respect for each other. That they disagree on so many things, but they meet in the middle so many times over and over and over again. The calendar does really well, and one of the hockey players is really over in the gay community in Sudbury because of the calendars. And
he's a big bald French dude or whatever else like that. And they're like, I don't know, like should he cut his hair or whatever? They're like, no, I think he's fine the way he is. They're trying to like figure it out, and they're like him, and Shorzy gets like jealous immediately, being like JJ's the one they want. Like he's the fattest guy on the team,
and that's the issue they have with going to the gay bar. They don't want to dance, and they're kind of freaked out that JJ is the popular one there. Has nothing to do with it being a gay bar. They're all completely okay with that. They just, you know, I don't really want to.
They're just mad that JJ is getting all the attention.
Why is JJ?
The energy, I get, I've never seen the show. The energy you guys are talking about is seriously Trailer Park Boys energy. The like.
I mean, Jonavision is in it.
Yeah, he is. I mean, it's similar. It's more rapid fire than Trailer Park Boys and like infinitely more wholesome. Like where you're just sort of like everybody is like pretty good and good to each other. Like,
there's not so much of that, but like the being okay with gay people and with every, you know, like,
yeah, a lot of that stuff is Trailer Park
Boys. That's like through and through in Trailer Park Boys.
What
I love the fact there's two French Canadians on the team, two like full on francophones that only speak French, but Diaby understands everything that's being said to him and replies in French, and everyone understands him, and JJ understands nothing that's being said to him. And replies almost unintelligibly.
Yeah. What's Jonathan Torrance's character? Is it like Remy Vachon or something?
Remy Nadeau.
He's like there's like the one person who does like the color, and then Jonathan Torrance, who's playing a French Canadian hockey broadcaster, is just sort of like Remy Nadeau. Like after the end of every call, he just says his name in French. The best. Like the other guy like does the entire play. And he's like, après ça, c'est un gros parti, c'est un gros match, whatever's like that. John and Remy Nadeau, and like leans back. It's so good.
What a goal, JJ Remy Nadeau.
JJ Frankie JJ. I will say
Jean-Jacques François Jacques Jean.
Yeah, so stupid.
JJ Frankie JJ.
I will say the one thing that I disagree, that I dislike about it is the subtitling. You miss a lot of what people are actually saying in French. There are like jokes that are not nowhere near like properly captured in French. When the three girls are like turning on them and they're playing with like the Québécois and the Québécoise, mm-hmm. like the gender play of that is just like non-existent in the subtitles at all. And they could have said like Quebec women or whatever, but I'm like, cause that's what they're saying. And a lot of what Dolo says is also completely like not translated correctly. Like gist, sure. But I was like, I feel like for the amount of actual French celebrities that they have on the show and the amount of dialogue that is in French, I thought they would have like
what about Hitchcock
rushed up a little bit.
Nonstop name dropping Canadian alternative rock artists from the '90s.
Yes.
Nonstop. So I mean, good.
And he knows nothing other than nineties alternative rock from Canada.
Canadian rock. Hey, I like your limb lifter t-shirt. So good.
We watched.
I'm more of
an
Age of Electric fan myself.
Watch Shorty, John. Not yet.
Hi, thanks for sticking around to the very end of this show. That means you're our number one fan. As our number one fan, maybe you're wondering a way that you can show your support for this. We've set up a few ways, and the boys are going to tell you about it now.
If you like this show, you might know other people that like the show, or maybe they'll like some of the other stuff that we're doing on the website. If that's the case, you can tell them all about it using all of the social networks like Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. We're on all of those. Or you could just, send people links directly to the website. Or if you live in a world without the internet and you only listen to podcasts, you can tell people about it with your human mouth. There's other ways we could support us, John.
If your interest in supporting us extends to the financial section, you might consider patreon.com/9to5cc. If you go there, you can get perks like early content, you can get your questions answered on the air, and you could get extra art.
We've been doing this show for a long time, so we kind of know what we're doing. Not really.
9to5.cc, podcasts, blogs, and comics, made in Montreal since 2011.